Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. Could just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for our super producer, Max the Great North Williams. What do you think that works?
It works. Yeah, it all works.
I am from the most northern state out of the three of us,
I believe. You're a Michigander, right?
I am a Michigander by birth.
That's the correct term, isn't it?
It is, 100% correct
Michigander
term.
That's hilarious.
So it was good for the Michigoose. It's good for the Michigander.
You're no Brown.
That's me.
I'm Ben Bolin. Today we're doing it with the help of our research associate, Max Williams,
the Michigander,
the Michigoose. Michigander,
Max, the Michigander Williams, doing some double duty here. We are continuing our weird mission, our Don Quixote-esque Quixotic mission to do an episode about every single state in these United States.
Punching windmills whenever we get the chance.
Sure. Well, that's on them for
punching
like giants.
Them, anyway. Yeah.
Jousting them. Yeah.
We're all completely mad. We're insane people.
Anybody who says they're not completely mad is lying to themselves or to you.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So where are we going?
Alaska.
Oh, nice. Nice, nice.
I'm sorry. I meant I'll ask her where we're going.
Oh, Alaska. I don't even know.
She's great. But it's true. We are going to Alaska, which is huge. It's mad big, y'all. Mm-hmm. Mad big. Giant landmass, much bigger than Vatican City. 663,268 square miles. Over a fifth of the side of the entire contiguous these United States, which is 3,119,884.69 miles. Take a breath.
Square. 669. Nice. Let's not forget. Thank you, Max.
I left the 69 in there on purpose.
Man.
For effect.
We're having a Cloud Atlas moment. I feel so seen. You know what? By way of segue, Max mentions was also big. World War II. World War II, as any history buff knows, began 1939.
Also known as the Gnarly War.
Mm-hmm, yes. Also known as World War II, the Warring. It ended in 1945. As of now, 2023, as we record, World War II is currently the deadliest and most destructive war in history, full stop.
Yeah, short of like another nuke being detonated, it will probably, you know, hold that title simply because the nature of warfare has just changed. It's a lot more targetable. It's a lot more precise. This was a ground conflict, you know, with people murdering each other with guns. And then, of course, you know, the big ones, the big boy, the little man, big man, little boy.
Little boy of fat man.
That's right. Big ups to Robert O. Oppenheimer. Mm-hmm. If anyone's seen that. Have you seen it yet? Have either of you seen Oppenheimer yet?
I've read a lot about it. There's an excellent graphic novel called Trinity.
Yes.
That actually, you remember this, because Matt Frederick and I, Matt introduced me to it, and we got a wild hair where we're going to try to make a podcast out of it. But from what I hear, Christopher Nolan basically nailed it.
There is a documentary that's available right now on the Criterion Channel called The Day After Trinity, mm-hmm. and that refers to something that Oppenheimer said in an interview when he was asked about the idea from the president at the time of stemming nuclear proliferation mm-hmm. or, you know, kind of pulling back nuclear, you know, armaments or whatever. And Oppenheimer said, we're many years too late. That should have begun, that effort should have begun the day after Trinity, which of course refers to the test of the nuclear bomb.
I want to shout out friend of the show, friend of ours, Patrice, who lives in Australia, who had this great suggestion, talking about Oppenheimer movie, had this great suggestion of doing an MCU approach to all these physicists and nuclear-related scientists. And I think stuff will get real spicy when they get to Parsons. You know, exactly. Sex cult guy. Well, moving on, right? War is hell. It drives many innovations, but it also shows humanity the worst of itself. More than 50 nations get entangled in the conflict. More than 100 million soldiers are deployed. Books and books and books have been written about World War II, not to mention the fact that films about World War II still come out continually every single year.
Mm-hmm. Saving Ryan's Privates?
Mm-hmm.
No, sorry. Yeah. That's the nudie version. Saving Private Ryan. Yeah, Storming the Beaches in Normandy, all of that good
Band
stuff.
Of Bum D-Day, Boys,
that's
I
the
think.
One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is Dunkirk World War II or is that World War I?
Yep, Dunkirk is two and also an excellent Christopher Nolan film.
Oh, yeah. Look at Christopher. So what we're saying is it's easy for some of these conflicts and some of these stories to get lost in the mix because so many crazy, terrible things happened. And here is something that you may not have known. I certainly didn't until Max asked us about it, Noel. There were World War II battles fought in Alaska. And of course, just so nobody else has to have this emotional roller coaster that I had, moose were not part of the battles.
Yeah, I've always would love the idea of like moose, which is its own plural, of course, mm-hmm. Being, you know, armored like some sort of attack bear, you know, situation.
Dude, I told you when I got back because I had to go to I was producing a show called Missing in Alaska and spent like 2 weeks or a little more than 2 weeks, I think, in that state right as October was coming. And moose run the town. Mm. This is something a lot of people who don't live in Alaska don't know. Alaskans have a hard time celebrating Halloween because moose like pumpkins, and they will just go and eat the jack-o'-lanterns and beat me here, Max. Fucking no one can stop them.
Yeah.
They're
massive. Yeah. If you kill a moose in Tears of the Kingdom, Legend of Zelda, it nets you 3 pieces of prime meat.
Oh, how many pieces of prime meat do other animals
typically have? Only one.
Oh, okay. So Zelda gets it.
Mm-hmm.
Nintendo gets it.
Nintendo also got World War II. because it's always, I mean, this is not really the point of today's episode, but I think the both of us find it fascinating how Japan is one country that had to just reinvent itself entirely, you know, essentially after having its old way of life annihilated by a nuclear weapon. Right. And they did so with gusto and repurposed themselves as this incredibly important cultural, pop cultural mecca, you know, for everything from toys to manufacturing to just culture.
Yeah.
Design, all of this stuff.
Nintendo was a playing card company. That's a success story. All right. So what we're saying is history of World War II, it's just chock full of terrible battles, lots of place names that become legendary. We mentioned Dunkirk, but what about Omaha Beach, Guadalcanal, Okinawa? To your point, Noel, there are 3 names you may not have heard of at all. Islands off the coast of Alaska, Adak, Atu and Kiska. They are part of the story of what's called the Aleutian Campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the elusive Aleutian Campaign, a chain of small islands known as the Aleutian Islands that separate the Bering Sea to the north from the main part of the Pacific Ocean to the south. They form kind of an arc to the southwest and then northwest for around 1,100 miles or 1,800 kilometers from the very tippity tip of the Alaskan Peninsula to the Attu Island that you mentioned, Ben.
As the moose flies.
Indeed, or as it, you know, gallops.
Yeah. The moose in Alaska can fly. If you have never been to Alaska, just take that on faith.
I think you're thinking of Rocky as opposed to Bullwinkle.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, there are also a lot of costumes on the moose. It's very popular. It's the annual moose cosplay festival. That's what you go up
there. A mainstay on the wall of hunting lodges.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So Americans, the American forces started in 1942. They struggled to take control of two of these islands, Attu and Kiska. And not only do they confront the Japanese, but they're really fighting two different battles. Not only are you fighting human enemies, but shout out to Jack London from To Build a Fire, you're fighting one of mankind's eternal enemies, the climate that you were not evolved to exist in.
The bitter, bitter cold.
It is incredibly cold. And the story of this battle, the series of conflicts, the defense of American soil, as you point out, Max, it has largely disappeared from the collective consciousness, which is why if you go to the Library of Congress, you're going to see titles like World War II's Unknown Campaign, because there hasn't been a film about this yet. And this is making me think it's time that we open up the pitch process for Ridiculous Studios again.
Yeah, maybe we can bring in Nolan to the process. Mm-hmm. He seems to be down for this type of content.
So tell us a little bit about the Aleutian Islands, man. What? I've never been to those islands, but no. They're part of Alaska.
No, but you may have heard of a chain of volcanoes in the Pacific known as the Ring of Fire, correct?
Oh, Johnny Cash.
Those are, in fact, a continuation of the Alaskan Aleutian Range, which are, in fact, underwater.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Johnny Cash song, Ring of Fire, is entirely about the likelihood of volcanic explosions and earthquakes in the Pacific. Think about it. Read the lyrics.
Or, at the very least, the volcanic explosion of love.
There we go. And most of these islands do show their volcanic origin. You can see evidence of that. And some of the volcanoes on those islands remain active today, thinking specifically of the Shishaldin volcano, which is near the center of Unimak Island. The shores are not your typical tourist destination. They're rocky. It's dangerous to approach them by water because the land rises abruptly from the coast to these big, big mountains. There's not really a fun beach, is what we're saying. Oh, and for 8,000 years, nobody lived there except for Aleutian people.
That's right. The Aleuts, also known as the Unangan. Mm-hmm. They were the only occupants of these islands. And by the time Russian explorers hit the scene, around 25,000 Unangan indigenous people dispersed to occupy the whole of the Aleutian Islands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in 1741, Russian forces send two dudes to explore the area. One is a Danish guy, Vitus Bering.
Is the Bering Strait named after
might
him?
Might sound familiar.
Yeah, I didn't look it up, but that has to be named after him. Yeah, it's right course. There.
It's like who invented the saxophone. So there's another guy, Alexei Chirikov, and he is Russian. And they're kind of doing like a maritime Lewis and Clark thing. So their ships become separated in a storm, and this leads Chirikov to, quote-unquote, discover several of the eastern islands. I'm saying quote-unquote discover because, of course, for almost 10,000 years, other people were living there, and they were continually discovering where they lived. So Bering, quote unquote, discovered several of these Western islands. Things went well for our buddy Vitas. He dies during the voyage. The crew survives. They come back to Russia. They say, "You guys, you know we love fur coats." And the Russians are like, "Yeah, man, we're Russian. Fur coats are one of our, you know, they're one of our big things." And they say, "There are so many furry animals out there. We should go hunting." So hunters come from all around Siberia and flock toward these islands. They move across the Aleutians, the Alaska mainland. And this is where Russia gets its foothold in North America. And they do this in a bloody parallel of what U.S. colonists would later do. They slaughter the Onungan people.
Yeah, that's sort of the vibe of, you know, folks coming into areas that they would like to think they discovered.
Right.
And then just contending with the inconvenient fact that there are already, like, you know, people hanging out there.
Let's tell Max. Max, we discovered this studio.
I'll slaughter you.
I believe it.
You'll try.
Yeah, the door locks from the outside.
Whoa. What?
Yeah.
Max is a bloodthirsty conqueror.
Yeah.
As well as a crack producer.
Yes. And the First Nations folks living there, the Onungan, who were not slaughtered, were enslaved or they were forced to relocate. Eventually, Russia sells the islands and the rest of Alaska to the United States in 1867. And the street name for this was Seward's Folly or Seward's Icebox, because literally everybody else in America thought it was the dumbest idea.
Oh, random history fact right here. When Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, it was a three-prong assassination attempt to get Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, and Seward. Seward actually got the attack happened. Johnson, the attack didn't happen. But Seward survived the assassination attempt. So that's his other footnote in history. That's the smaller one behind he bought Alaska.
Got it.
Max with the facts.
So in 1942, you might have heard of a little thing called Pearl Harbor. 6 months before that fateful Japanese attack that really kicked off World War II in earnest, in Hawaii, the Japanese were eyeing the Aleutian Islands.
They were, yes. This is very true. And once they reached the island chain, this archipelago, Japanese forces started conducting airstrikes on Dutch Harbor, which was the site of two U.S. military bases. They started this on June 3rd and June 4th. Then they made landfall at Kiska Island on June 6th. And then just a day later, they make landfall on Attu Island, about 200 miles away. They quickly establish pop-up military bases on both islands.
Does it feel like some of these indigenous names, you know, for these islands that obviously descended from the people who live there were possibly inspiration for some Star Wars things?
Oh, 100%.
It feels that way. I mean,
yeah, I know. That's a good call.
Attu Island just really feels very much in the Star Wars universe.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
The Japanese garrison their forces there, establish military bases on both Kiska and Attu Islands. And very similarly to other islands in the Aleutian chain, Attu and Kiska didn't really represent much of a military stronghold, strategically speaking, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that, man, because they didn't have a ton of resources. There are rocks in the far north. They had a lot of harsh weather.
They're out of the way.
They're out of the main way of the conflict. They have a lot of crazy storms and fog and rain. And, you know, it snows a lot. If you ask historians after the fact, you'll hear a lot of them argue that Japan seized those two islands because they wanted to divert attention during the Japanese attack on Midway Island, which was occurring June 4th through 7th in 1942. And so they were trying to get the U.S. Navy to misdirect its forces.
Like a diversion.
Right, right. And they also thought, apparently, and this makes sense, that holding those islands could stop the U.S. from invading Japan's home islands. Because once you get to that top of the globe, Japan is a lot closer to the Aleutian Islands than we might assume.
Does it make sense maybe that the Japanese would have targeted these island chains because it was something they were kind of comfortable with in terms of, you know, military operations, you know, because it's similar layout to their home turf?
Yeah, it's similar. It's easier to get to. It's also, yeah, it goes into kind of the island hopping strategy. But they are, again, the Bering Sea and the Sea of Okhotsk separate them, but they're very close. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and jump in real quick. There is this interesting thread that I've really been kind of pulling on in history, and we've actually talked about it a number of times. I kind of think this is like part 3 or 4 of a series that we have, which, spoiler, there's another part already in the works where it's like this fear of Japanese invasion.
Yeah.
On the west coast of America. It was never really a thing that was ever actually that close. But, you know, we have the fire balloons. We have the guy who tried to firebomb Oregon.
Yeah.
It was Japan was always trying to keep this narrative going. They're like, hey, America, we're not that far away.
Watch out.
Yeah. Which is like, I mean, there's not really any proof that they ever got to the point where they thought invading the U.S. was feasible because it's so far.
Well, yeah. And we should draw a differentiation there between U.S., the whole thing, and continental U.S., because Hawaii is in the middle of the ocean. So from a strategic standpoint, the Pearl Harbor attack makes sense for Japan. It would have been much more feasible than attacking, say, San Francisco. Anyway.
But yeah. It was a big deal to have the Japanese occupying any portion of American soil, no matter how out of the way.
100%.
Like philosophically speaking.
Yeah, you know? Symbolically. How dare thee? So they know it's remote. They know it's barren. But they're saying Japanese troops are on U.S. soil. They're occupying U.S. land. And they stoke this fear amongst themselves. Not without some justification. They say, look, these forces this might be the first step in an attack on Alaska or, you know, even the entirety of the Pacific Northwest. And the press is drumming up a lot of bloody headlines about this, but the people in charge of the American war effort, from what I understand, man, they're still trying to figure out how to survive Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. That's you know, mission critical. That's like item number one on the to-do list.
Right, right. And so their attention is already kind of in a couple of different places. Japan occupies these islands for months. And for a while, for the first few months, all the U.S. military does is sort of fly by and bomb stuff occasionally. Sort of an effort to show that they are doing something.
In the meantime, the Japanese soldiers who have garrisoned on these islands are doing a bang-up job of getting very cozy, relatively as cozy as you can get in these very harsh climates. The Japanese Navy is keeping them stocked with, you know, snacks. You gotta have their war snacks and also, you know, arms, of course, and ammunition and fuel and all of that kind of stuff. So by January of 1943, the U.S. has sort of beefed up its Alaskan command to the tune of around 94,000 soldiers. They've set up several bases around and on other Aleutian Islands. And on January 11th, troops from that Alaskan command make landfall on Amchitka Island, which is about 50 miles from Kiska Island, one of the two main ones that the Japanese are occupying.
Yeah, and this is where we have to introduce U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Thomas C. Kincaid. And I want to stop and say, you know, thank you to all our veterans tuning in.
Yes.
We have not ever been members of the Navy, and I will never not think Rear Admiral is low-key a hilarious
It's funny.
Name.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of military terms associated with leadership do kind of have a little bit of a tee-hee quality to them.
Also, you guys, cool, if I jump in real quick, I got some pretty intense facts right here. The temperature currently on Attu Station in Alaska is 53 degrees. We were recording this in August.
53 below?
No, just 53 degrees below.
Oh.
And in Kiska, it is supposed to get up to 55 today.
Sorry. Boiling, global boiling.
Yeah. Oh, right. So, but that's not insane, right? That's what we're talking, like 53. It's cold, but it's not like...
It's the height of August.
Yeah.
So it's, it's the height of August, so it'd be one of the warmest months in the Northern Hemisphere. That's about as hot as it gets, even with all the hard work we've done throwing all those pollutants in the air. Everybody get back to the coal.
Exactly.
Because it's still too chilly in Alaska. Anyway, sorry. So U.S. Navy Rear Admiral Kincaid, Noel, why are we introducing this guy?
Well, because he set up a blockade of Attu and Kiska to help kind of stem the flow of those supplies, those snacks and armaments all the other goodies that the Japanese are supplying to the occupiers there. And on March 26th of 1943, the Japanese ships that are afloat in the Bering Sea try to get around the blockade and deliver some supplies. This is very Star Wars-y, too. Remember that whole Star Wars movie that's just about the blockade?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, really, really powerful stuff. You know, no, it's not. That movie has always eluded me. It's so, like, talky, you know, government-y stuff.
Which movie is it?
I think it was The Phantom Menace that starts off with like, all the alien guys talking about it. The blockade. It's a blockade.
Oh, I barely remember The Phantom Menace. Did you ever hear the theory that, and this is... This is really interesting fan theory.
That goes Attack of the Clones, actually. That was the blockade.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Attack of the Clones sounds like that because they go get the clones because they need to break the blockade.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay.
Hello. This is Future Max here, i.e. the guy producing the episode, not on the recording. Yeah, I led Noel astray. He's correct. It is The Phantom Menace, not Attack of the Clones. To be completely honest, I don't know the plot of either of those movies. I've seen them. I've definitely seen them. But I don't know. I don't actually really remember anything else about the movie, but I wanted to add this addendum in here. So there's that.
Solved it.
That movie was terrible. So
not good.
No one remembers
not good.
Here's the question. Have you guys ever heard the theory that Lucas originally wanted Jar Jar Binks to be revealed as a Sith Lord?
Yep.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. That's a theory.
Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Okay.
But it's like one of those things, you know, wait until 2 a.m., watch the YouTube documentary about it. It's way too long.
Maybe he pivoted because the character was just so blasphemously unpopular.
Yeah. And coded in some really racist
ways. Howdy, was it ever. And poor guy. There's a whole thing where the guy that played the voice of Jar Jar Binks, I believe is the voice, and he also was the model that they based the CGI movements out of. That guy kind of, at no fault of his own, sort of got canceled because of, you know, because of George Lucas's ill-informed attempts at making that character.
By the way, if you go into Google, because I was going to look up who the actor was, but you type in Jar Jar Binks, first suggestion is Jar Jar Binks is not a Sith. Second suggestion, Jar Jar Binks is a Sith Lord.
Cool.
We important
and oddly enough, number priority. Three is Jar Jar Binks is a Sith Lord, etc. crossword.
It's like history. It rhymes, you know?
Yeah. The answer is theory or fan theory. Anyway, for the crossword, anybody who's playing that.
Can we just say that this, look, it's a blockade. He's attempting to, the Japanese ships are trying to break through the blockade, but they are spotted by some U.S. ships that are patrolling the area, and a skirmish, I guess you could call it, begins, you know, a sea battle. I don't know if it was big enough to call it. Well, no, it had a name. It was the Battle of the Komondorski Islands, which is a fun name. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the Japanese have had a little bit of a head start. So they're already, you know, out gunning and outnumbering. Yes, they're dug in real good. And the U.S. fleet has a hard time matching their forces, and they are seriously hobbled, you know, by the Japanese ships. So the American side suffers some serious casualties after quite a few hours of fighting. The Japanese ships then suddenly decide to withdraw. Why is that?
You know, it's because they were worried the heat was around the corner. They thought bombers were arriving because they were estimating how long it would take for American forces to contact each other and how long from there it would take for U.S. bombers to come and just rain fire on the islands.
Okay. Got it. Its own kind of ring of fire there. So after the battle, the Japanese soldiers that are garrisoned there on Attu and Kiska are incredibly isolated because they don't that flow of supplies they were had grown accustomed to has stopped. It was unsuccessful.
No more snacks in the break room.
No more snacks in the break room. Exactly. They're having to kind of fend for themselves. Their supplies are diminishing significantly. They do get intermittent deliveries, secret submarines delivering to them, but you can only go so far with that, right?
Right.
Because they're not huge. You know, you can't.
Yeah, the submarine's coming up and it's throwing like a 24-pack of chips out and going back under.
Yeah, some Gatorade and like, Zero. Yeah.
These aren't even Lay's chips. This is what...
I want Ruffles. Right. Where are my Ruffles?
Dude, okay. I suspect that the three of us might have the same hierarchy of chips.
Oh, I think that's possible.
It's going to have the Fritos in there. And you're like, damn it. And there's going to be a bowl full of disappointment. Fritos.
There's such an also-ran. Anyway, that has nothing to do with it because you're making a very important point. Whatever a submarine can deliver is probably going to be survival rations.
Yep. Are we talking like MRE type things on the Japanese side too? Or, you know, would they have been different? I wonder, and I'm just conjecturing here, like, you know, obviously the Japanese, when did like dry, like ramen noodles and things become invented?
After World War
II. It was after World War II. Okay.
Momofuku Ando.
That's right. Okay. We talked about that recently, but I'm wondering what those rations might have looked like because we know about MREs. We talked about that pretty extensively. I'm curious as to what Japanese rations looked like, if there was any parallel thinking there.
They had something called Imperial Japanese rations that were served in these little tin boxes and you had to cook them yourself. There are a couple of articles and sources you can find. They usually had rice and then some kind of protein and then vegetables, pickled vegetables most likely, and green tea. Sometimes you would get barley instead of rice. And then you were sort of expected to forage for other stuff. So these guys, if they're getting Imperial, they might be getting those rations. They might just be getting rice and being told, hey, get water, cook the rice. It's definitely not ideal. And the American forces are thinking, all right, this is our opportunity to storm the beach, to land troops on the islands and take the combat to these Japanese garrisons. This is the origin of something with the unfortunate name Operation Land Crab.
Have I told you that my nickname for my girlfriend is the Crab?
No, you have not told
me. I often refer to you as the Crab.
Why?
Like, not just my little crab or my crab. I say, hello, the Crab.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I text her, I'll just say, the Crab? Question mark.
How
is an emoji that is a crab. She described herself as a bit of a recluse early on in our relationship, so I called her a hermit crab. Yeah. But it's become a term of affection, so I often refer to her as the crab. So our home is also littered with crab plushies and crab. I have like a pair of Crocs with crab. What do you call those little dingles that go on?
The
decorative flair for Crocs.
Do you guys do you have a name based on?
I'm the butterfly because she thinks I'm a bit of a. She's a shut in. I'm a social butterfly.
Oh, okay,
but these terms have taken on their own meaning.
That's
over
endearing.
Time.
Relationship creates its own language.
My girlfriend would approve of Operation Land Crab, and when I hear that, I immediately think of her with affection.
That one's for you, Day. Does she listen to the show?
Nope.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, like we said, American ships have been sporadically bombing the islands for a while. On May 11th, 1943, the U.S. enacts Operation Land Crab. 11,000 U.S. troops land on Attu, which is, again, not the world's biggest island. The Americans are a little chuffed about this. They're a little optimistic. They say, we're going to be done in like a couple days, you guys, because they didn't know how bad the weather was going to be. They didn't know how terrible the terrain was. Their short mission ends up lasting more than 2 weeks.
I love like classic military men turns of phrase, you know, when describing conflicts. And Lieutenant Donald E. Dwinnell, which is another great military man name, described it as such. It was rugged. The whole damn deal was rugged, like attacking a pillbox by way of a tightrope. In winter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite get it. attacking a pillbox by way of a tightrope.
Yeah, so like, you know, a pillbox is, you've got that, it's like a concrete enclosure with a little slit where people can shoot.
Oh, not actually a pillbox of pills. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. the visual wasn't working on me, but I get it now. But yeah.
But still, that is a beautiful turn of language. They also, so now that's what we talked about at the very beginning. So they have two enemies now. They have the Japanese forces who are already entrenched and dug in, and then they have the just terrible, terrible weather. It turns out that the weather was responsible for more U.S. casualties than any actual enemy combatant.
That's right. More than 2,100 American soldiers were removed from the conflict, taken out of action is how the National Park Service refers to this as in their article, Battle of Attu 60 Years Later, which we highly recommend giving a read. So that means killed or injured, right? Taken out of combat.
Right, right.
Due to the horrible conditions.
Yeah, they are no longer operators.
Things like disease would have come into play.
Trench foot.
Right, exactly. So these would have been also referred to as non-battle injuries, while around 1,700 were killed or injured by Japanese forces.
Yeah. It turns out when they were thinking through Operation Land Crab, despite the fact that they were familiar with the islands, despite the fact that people in general understand Alaska is cold, Uncle Sam had not taken the weather into account. So they didn't have the right kind of gear to operate there. They were falling victim to frostbite, exposure. Trench foot is thankfully something, I hope no one's ever experienced this.
Is it like gangrene?
It's super nasty. Okay. It can become gangrene. It's like imagine you're walking through wet, crappy environments for weeks and you never get to change your socks.
Ooh, so it basically, your foot starts to rot.
Yeah.
Essentially, or just like, oh God.
Yeah. If you don't treat it, it can become gangrenous and result in amputation.
Lots of bacteria and things can form, 100%. You know, in this nasty, kind of fetid, closed situation, you know, in your boot foot
into a terrarium for bacteria, right? Even more so.
Think of it as like really advanced athlete's foot.
Terrible, terrible stuff. And, you know, we have to exercise humanity, realize that a lot of these Japanese soldiers are laboring under the same brutal conditions. They're not having a good day either. Just like any war, I'm sure there are a lot of soldiers on either side who are going, ugh, why do I have to be here? But because these guys weren't dressed warmly enough, the U.S. soldiers had to keep moving to keep their circulation going. And sometimes that meant they would expose themselves to enemy fire. Some of them were too beat up to walk, so they crawled around. And when they killed Japanese soldiers, they stole their clothing to stay warm. And that leads to friendly fire, because now you are dressed as an enemy soldier.
The term friendly fire always kind of cracks me up. It's the least friendly thing you can imagine. Yeah. It just, of course, not to say the obvious, but it refers to, you know, accidentally shooting someone that's on your team.
Right, right. And it is a very real thing.
It's like an own goal.
Yeah, it has happened in every single modern conflict. So this battle has already kind of been decided. The fate of the Japanese is sealed as soon as the Americans establish air and naval supremacy, which, despite Pearl Harbor, is still only a matter of time because the U.S. is much closer. They cut those supply lines. They made it unlikely for reinforcements to arrive. And by May, the last remaining Japanese troops were starving.
Yeah,
running out of bullets.
Give a quick read or a long read to, it's not a particularly long article, but to the Battle of the Aleutian Islands from history.com from back in 2009. It was actually updated as recently as 2020. So lots of good resources there for this chronology that we're pulling from. The commander of the Japanese forces, Colonel Yasuyo Yamasaki, decides to give it one last hurrah, one last push. And right before morning on May 29th, he leading his forces, they execute what's referred to a bonsai charge, which is a term that I was not intimately familiar with. And this was apparently a tactic that was employed during the war in the Pacific, of course.
Overwhelming numbers.
That's right.
Everybody runs at once.
Mm-hmm. And so Yamasaki's troops do the big charge. It really is kind of like just a murderous rampage, essentially, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a dangerous tactic as well. This becomes one of the largest bonsai charges of its time.
It's one where you're not worried about people dying. It's just you're putting all your cards on the table.
Right.
Cannon fodder city.
You're literally throwing bodies at a problem. And they did this out of desperation. So they charge into the American lines. They sweep through the combat outpost. They get all the way to the support troops in the rear of the camp. They almost succeed. But after a final attack on May 30th, the U.S. soldiers win the day. They've counted more than 2,000 Japanese casualties, including the commander. They lost around, the U.S. lost around 1,000 men retaking Attu. And then within 2 days, they had secured the island, and the Battle of Attu, the only land battle ever fought on American soil in World War II, was over. Shout out also to the National Park Service.
I know, right?
They've got great articles on this.
They truly do. You know, what we just described, Ben, sounds more like an episode of Game of Thrones
than
it does modern warfare.
Yeah.
And that's why it makes sense this was such a deadly war, because these types of tactics, they just don't make sense anymore, you know, because of the nature of combat has just changed. So this type of land charge, I just picture men on horses with lances or something, you know? But instead, it's people, you know, running while firing machine guns and bayoneting people and stuff. But it's not that different.
And honestly, to give you a sense of the desperation, when people are starving and you want them to make a suicide run like this, sometimes all you have to do is tell them that there's food in the enemy camp.
Jesus.
Right.
That level of desperation is just mind-boggling. And while this might sound like the end of the story, there is one more operation of note that I think is worth, at the very least, kind of breezing through without, for fear of giving short shrift to literally the loss of human lives and just the vast, overwhelmingly deadly nature of this entire conflict. This one actually was not so bad.
This is the ridiculous one.
It is.
This is the ridiculous one. So remember we said there were two islands that were the that form the setting or the theater for this conflict. The 11th Army Air Force and the Navy Patrol Wing 4 get their assignment to take back Kiska Island in something called Operation Cottage, which is not as creative. They're told literally push the enemy into the sea, get the island back. And this is after Attu.
Literally? Push them into the sea?
Push them into the sea.
Okay.
And so they said, look, we've got lessons learned. We're going to give you the right clothing. We're going to give you the right gear and equipment. And you are going to encounter way more troops than we faced at Attu. And so on August 5th, 1943, they arrive at Kiska. They've already been told the weather's going to be horrible. This is going to be way harder than the other island. The weather is nice.
Mm-hmm.
The sea is quiet. And there's no one there.
Yeah, they have themselves a little beach chill. No, they don't. But they're certainly probably surprised, you know, in the positive direction because they've been prepared for the absolute worst. And they get there and it's an absolute cakewalk. And there is an actual reason for this. The Japanese forces had abandoned their post. On July 29th, 1943, the Japanese forces stationed on Kiska decided to hightail it out of there. Kiska City, which is what they were referring to their outpost as, was wired with explosives and demolished, including all of their supplies, ammunition, and outposts.
They had booby traps.
Exactly. But they did this in advance of the Americans arriving, though, right?
Yeah.
They didn't want to leave them anything that would be of use.
Yeah, we have a statement from Carl Kasukabe, who was there. He was a Japanese veteran and said, quote, we threw our rifles and bayonets into the water and then we went away.
Mm-hmm.
They never saw us. So in 55 minutes, the entire Japanese force there, over 5,000 people, boarded the vessels. They drifted off silently into the night. And the word for that is noctivagant, which we recently learned.
Oh, wow.
That's about in the night.
That's a good one. It would make sense, nocturnal being the root, I imagine. The Allies had a hard time believing that this wasn't some sort of ruse.
Yeah, imagine running.
They're going to pop out any minute. They're somewhere.
It's funny because it's ridiculous, right? Imagine you're running full bore onto the shore. You've got your firearm locked and loaded. You might be yelling. You might just be like, How long do you keep yelling until you notice that no one's there except maybe there's a moose who is like, come on, man.
I just picture, it's like that scene in Spinal Tap where they're like lost and can't find the stage and they're just pumped up about like, let's rock and roll. Yeah. And then they turn a corner and they realize they're not there yet. So they kind of like get flustered and then, okay, let's get back. Let's get the energy back.
Get it back.
I picture them like screaming and then they turn a corner. No one's there. Okay. They're definitely going to be around this next corner. Okay, let's get up the energy again. And then no one. So after, again, in our version of events, several of these highs and lows, right. They finally accept the fact that there truly is no one around.
Yes, and they are still fighting the weather. So there are, unfortunately, fatalities. 24 Allied troops are killed by, again, friendly fire. 4 die due to Japanese booby traps. Yeah, 71 die when one ship hits a floating mine. And then a lot of other guys, 168 either get wounded or they fall ill, probably due at least in part to the weather.
That's right. We're around 8 days of this, looking around and realizing that finally no one was there. This was, at the end of the day, on paper, I guess, perhaps to save face. I would imagine written off as a training exercise.
Okay, sure.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice. That's like, I have a bad habit of, Noel and Max both know this. I have a bad habit of doing something klutzy and then just immediately looking at whomever has seen it, making eye contact and yelling on purpose.
Yeah, I've borrowed that tactic from you. It's a good one, Ben. It's a good one. So, at the end of the day, this represents a defeat of the Japanese forces at the Aleutian Islands. And very interesting story. It's got some, the intensity of this conflict. Conflict is represented. We got a little ridiculousness thrown in there. I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, none of this can be seen as purely ridiculous, although the foibles and follies of man are nothing if not ridiculous at times. But I think this is a really interesting kind of little encapsulation of the entire conflict. And I'm surprised that it hasn't been dramatized, because it seems like exactly the kind of story that would really play well on screen.
I want to at least see the moment where they run onto the abandoned island.
Yeah.
I want that moment.
Definitely how it went down. No question.
and you describe it well. It is a microcosm of a larger horrific conflict that fundamentally altered the course of the world, and the consequences of World War II continue to echo and resonate today. The war continues for 2 years after the Battle of the Aleutian Islands. Japan finally surrenders to the Allies on September 2nd, 1945. This basically ends World War II. And now if you go to these islands, you'll see the battlefields there have become national historical landmarks in recognition of this singular, unique conflict that, again, a lot of people don't know about. And that's why we owe a big, big thanks to our research associate and super producer, Max, the Great North Michigander.
The Michigoose is what I'm sticking
the Moosagander?
All of those things. Okay. It contains multitudes.
Williams is his last name.
And also,
there are moose in Michigan. Also, do you guys know what the plural of moose is?
It's moose.
Yes.
We already talked about that. That was the first thing I said. It's its own plural.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite things about the humble moose. But yeah, also huge thanks to the elder Williams, Alex, who composed this banging track that you're listening to right this very second. Jonathan Strickland, our human booby trap, if ever there was one.
Oh, he'll like that one, a.k.a. the Quister. And of course, big, big thanks to Eve's Jeffcoat, who, unlike Tipper Gore, has a show coming out on our network.
It's true. Glad we cleared that one up.
Yeah, that was a good save, yeah. And thanks, of course, to Christopher Hasiotis, I was talking with Christopher earlier, and he hipped me to some amazing facts about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, specifically famine.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's a hungry boy.
He's that kind of dude.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Avalon Waterways. Ben, are you in major need of a vacation right now?
Noel, you're a mind reader. I am, and aren't we all?
We are. While cruising remains popular, there's something big happening in the industry, and that is, my friend, smaller ships.
True story. The intimate ships of Avalon Waterways can go where the big ships can only dream, through winding passageways of rolling vineyards and castled hills into the heart of timeless cities and storybook villages.
That sounds like a delight. See how Avalon's smaller ships promise greater discoveries, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.